Welcome to Surprisingly Free from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. I'm your host, Jerry Brito. Our website is surprisinglyfree.com, where you can subscribe to the show, find other episodes, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. Our email address is info@surprisinglyfree.com. We'd love to hear from you. Today is August 9th, 2013, and my guest is Sherwin C., Vice President of Legal Affairs at Public Knowledge, where he coordinates the organization's legal work specializing in emerging copyright issues. Sherwin, welcome to Surprisingly Free.
Thanks, Jerry. Great to be here.
So, Sherwin, as I said, your specialty is copyright, which is an issue that you track very closely. And in the past few weeks and months, there has been a lot of activity in the copyright space. And I thought we'd take this opportunity to sort of discuss what's been going on and what you think about it. Mm-hmm. So let's start with what seemingly kicked this all off, which is that the Register of Copyright, Maria Payante, called for reform. You want to tell us what she said and why she did that?
So, earlier this year, the Register of Copyrights, Maria Payante, said that, you know, she recognized that there was a need for copyright law to be updated, that we've got, you know, a series of laws that were last really framed decades and decades ago, and that the world around that, around those laws, has changed significantly. So there's a lot that can be done.
So what are some of those discrepancies that have bubbled up since law was last revisited?
Well, a lot of the things, I mean, some of them can get pretty detailed, but for example, the process by which, I mean, being that she's at the Copyright Office, mm-hmm. she might focus on things that a lot of us, I think, might not pay as much attention to, such as how people register their works. But that, which is incredibly important, actually, when it comes to figuring out who actually owns stuff. And that leads to questions about what you can and can't use. How do you get permission to do that? If you can't get permission, how can you be sued, or how should you not be able to be sued? Things like that. There's also a lot of questions that she was, you know, willing to note coming up about things like digital first sale. You know, who owns a digital file when you download it? You know, when you buy a track off of iTunes, what makes sure that you get to actually own that? Can you resell it? Can you give it away? And things like that.
So today, if you go to the store and you buy a CD, that CD is unquestionably yours. It's physical property. It's yours. And you can resell that to anybody you want. You can rent it if you want to do that.
Actually, weirdly, CDs...
You can't rent it?
You can't.
No, that's right.
A DVD you could, because there's this weird thing specifically in the law, because they were worried about that, about people basically... Actually, they were worried about shops basically renting out records and renting out and selling blank tapes at the same time, like in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
So weirdly enough, video games and actually not all video games, but basically computer software and records, you can't rent. Everything else you can.
Which this is, I mean, just that right there goes to show how complicated and how convoluted copyright law is to talk about. Because whenever you think you've got a straightforward rule, no, there's always an exception. There's always a caveat.
Yeah.
And then that caveat creates a new interest on the part of somebody.
And I think this is, you know, a lot of the things that the Register was saying, you know, probably deserve a second look at, have a lot to do with things like that, with things that also sort of mutate over time. Like, for example, you know, you have, if you play a song on the radio, you have to pay the songwriter a license fee or get their permission. But the people who actually made the recording actually don't have a copyright that the radio station has to pay them. Do the exact same thing over the internet, and then they actually do have, you do have to get their permission. You do have to pay them a license fee.
And then the question is, I mean, so intuitively, what somebody hearing that would say, well, that doesn't sound very fair. We should have one rule for everybody. And usually it's, you know, the thought would be, let's bring everybody up to the same rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think about that?
You know, I think that's not a bad way to go. I mean, I've heard lots of people, you know, lots of people I agree with on a lot of things say, well, why not go the other way and remove that? Honestly, I think if the idea of copyright or at least the way it's supposed to work, is to reward creators so that they keep creating stuff. I think that there's a balance that you can reach where yeah, you know, you can give that right across the board, but do it in a way where it doesn't get in the way of people making ordinary uses of stuff.
Yeah, it just seems to me that when you're analyzing sort of these discrepancies, you shouldn't think about you know, how to make it so that everybody's getting the same treatment and bring everybody up necessarily, but just as you say, think the analysis should be what's going to get us the amount of creation that we want.
Right. I mean, and, you know, when I say that that's the way that copyright works, right? I mean, just to go back to the, sort of the constitutional rationale for it, it's you know, what the idea behind copyright is to make sure that there's an incentive for people to create stuff. The ultimate end goal is to have more creative works in the world, and to promote the progress of science or the useful arts, as they say. Now, the means to that end that are in the Constitution is, okay, we'll create exclusive rights for artists. Right. But that's the means to the end.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that, you know, having a public performance right seems like a pretty reasonable means to the end of encouraging performance and recording of performances. But then when you, it's all when you start getting down to the details.
Exactly. You know,
now
you
what's
get...
it going to cost to do that? And what are we going to start charging people to make use of this stuff?
And would you get any less creation if you didn't have that right? I mean, so if you think about, you know, television or film actors are performing, but they don't have a license to those works. And we seem to get as many movies as we need.
Yeah, I mean, what's funny is in a lot of those cases, you know, things are going to be dealt with via contract. You're not going to see, I think that especially because you're required in a, you know, motion picture sort of scenario to get a whole ton of people together in a sort of a larger scenario where you're going to necessarily have contracts or otherwise people get in trouble really, you know, pretty fast, as opposed to, you know, what it takes to for somebody to get permission to just do a cover song is going to be a very different sort of dynamic. If you're an actor involved in a movie, I think it's much more likely that somebody who's putting that entire production together is the one who's, you know, clearing the rights for all that stuff, and it's not the actor who's going to be considered infringing. The actor is really, you know, even if they're not working for hire, they're part of a much larger collective that's creating that new work.
Right.
In the case of somebody just doing a cover, I mean, you know, we have compulsory licenses for that. The idea being that if somebody's written a song and that's been recorded and put out in the world already, somebody else can come along, cover that song, and make their own album for it. Now they have to pay the person who wrote the song, but they don't have to run around and get permission. I mean, Congress created that law specifically in order to keep there from being a disparity of market power. They were worried that record labels would actually go around, buy up the rights to all of the songs, and then prevent anyone else from singing them.
Right, and we would be poor for that.
Exactly. I mean, you think of, you know, all the, you know, amazing cover versions that actually improve upon the originals, right? All Along the Watchtower would not be what it is if all we had was the Dylan version.
So let's talk about what Congress is doing now, sort of in response to this call from the Register of Copyrights. So Bob Goodlatte, who is the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, has begun to move sort of slowly on this reform. Do you want to talk to us about what the process has been so far and what you think about it?
Sure. I mean, you know, you say slowly. I think that's right. So they've had three hearings so far, and each one has been very sort of general, right? And very on a very abstract level. We had one where I think the stated purpose from the chairman was basically, we want to show people that it is possible to come to agreement on these things, that there are principles for copyright reform that can be laid out. And Pam Samuelson, a professor at Berkeley, who, you know, had put together a project bringing together rights holders and technology companies and academics of all sorts to try and come up with those principles. She was one of the main witnesses at that. And I think that was the point of that, is to say, look, you know, these have been incredibly contentious things in the past. There's certainly going to be arguments in the future, but there is a series of things that people can, in theory, agree upon. So let's go from there. That was a few months ago. And then we had a couple of hearings, one last week and one the week before that. And they were each entitled Innovation in America. The first one was Innovation in America, : the role of copyrights. And the second one was Innovation in America, : the role of technology. And I think each of those was sort of a chance for people from either, I guess, the content creation industry and people from the technology industry to basically talk about, you know, their role in the economy and, I guess, present their perspective.
Well, I mean, so I saw many folks being sort of critical of the structure of these hearings, including yourself, sort of noting that the dichotomy here, that Congress seems to think that the copyright issue is two sides battling it out, one side being what the committee called the copyright industry, which I don't know what that means, or the copyright sector of the economy, mm-hmm. and then on the other hand, technology companies,
right?
And you say it's kind of like a false dichotomy.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things that I think that bothered me about the way that those hearings were entitled. It sounds like a thing. It sounds like I'm being nitpicky and sort of needlessly bothered and word nerdly about it. But really, I think that it does.
It sort of speaks to the way they're thinking about it.
That's right. I mean, and part of it is first of all saying that, you know, that this is the copyright industry that's represented by, say, the Society of Media Photographers or record labels or Getty Images. I think that everybody who, you know, creates creative works that can be fixed in a tangible medium, is a copyright holder. And anyone who does that has the potential for making that into some form of economic activity. Everybody creates and everybody uses. So, you know,
I mean, right now we're recording a podcast.
Yeah.
You know, this is a creative activity. I want to give this away for free so mm-hmm. that it reaches as many people as possible. Yet I'm not really represented by Getty Images or anybody else at that hearing.
And to that point, I don't know that we've actually made any agreement as to who owns the copyright. It could be a joint authorship situation.
That's right. I can't wait to be served in the morning.
Right. I'll be sure. We'll be, you know, incredibly litigious plaintiffs. Just for our own stuff. Now we license our website under Creative Commons. So
and you rely on copyright to do that.
Oh yes, most definitely. But to get back to the point, so I guess the idea of this dichotomy is, you know, people, and I think it's a very easy story to tell in Congress. It's a very easy story to tell in the press and in business press, where you have, two industries fighting it out. It's a very, you know, it's you can set that up. It's a classic battle. You can use all sorts of sports metaphors. It's great, but really, it's I think most of the people who are represented on the content side actually share a lot in common with a lot of the people on the tech side, in that they're all, in a sense, intermediaries. They're all, in a sense, means for artists to get stuff out to audiences. And it's really the constitutional, the two parties that the Constitution cares about are the artists and their audiences, the general public. Whether you're a record label that's, you know, trying to provide promotional value by buying up recording artist copyrights, getting them studio time, all that stuff, or you're a search engine who's indexing the stuff that people are putting up on the web, you're in that middle trying to, you know, serve a purpose in getting content from the artist to the user. And I would want to make sure that the nature of that isn't obscured. I'm not trying to downplay the economic significance of everything that happens in the middle, but the legal purpose of it is, you know, a little bit secondary.
And so what does that mean for policy, right? So what should Congress go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because a lot of the times, people will ask about, you know, where are artists being represented? Are actual artists being represented? And I think that's an excellent question. I think people need to know what the definition of actual artists are. It's not just the people who belong to professional societies. It's also people like Cory Doctorow, who I think would have a number of things to say as a copyright holder that might not agree with what the Copyright Alliance might have to say, for example.
But isn't he, or how do I put this, isn't the tech sector a proxy for the interests that somebody like Cory Doctorow might have?
Oh, no. I mean, definitely not. I think, you know, there might be some alignment there. But look, my interests are not the interests of Google. You know, Google has an interest in, has an interest in controlling access to information, just as anyone else sitting on a giant repository of information and the means to get to it can. Now, they've built their model on giving that away freely, giving a lot of that away freely and making access to it public. So to the extent that they do that, that's great. But they do that as a means to the end of making a profit and being a viable company. And that end is not the same end. It does not align exactly with the progress of science and the useful arts.
So if you were designing a fourth hearing for this committee,
That's actually interesting. I mean, part of the issue is, you know, how you want to represent people. I mean, and part of it is the idea that you can represent all of the stakeholders by selecting four or five people and sticking them in front of Congress to get drilled by questions from members who show up from time to time. You know, that's a little artificial. You know, ideally, I think you'd see a variety of direct artists. You'd see a variety of people who are making uses of those things and action and users of the stuff who aren't. You know, part of it is that uses don't always have ledgers, by which I mean, mm-hmm. You know, when people think of it in terms of technology companies versus content companies, it's easy to try and quantify uses because these companies will quantify their profits, their losses, and their you know the costs of doing business. The thing is, there is a cost to a new book being enjoined because I don't know, one of the heirs of the subject of the book objects to it, and that cost is hard to measure in dollar value. It's the cost of individuals not getting that information. There's a cost when a video, a political video, gets taken down on copyright grounds, and you know people don't learn about a candidate, something that they really ought to know, and that cost is incredibly difficult to quantify. And so, you know, there are, it. And what's funny is when, as I'm saying this, I'm keeping in mind the fact that there's a lot of people who will, when they're, so both sides. There I am diving into this dichotomy, right? You know, but you know, both of these industries will talk about numbers and studies and how much they contribute to the economy. And whenever they think that that their numbers aren't holding up, then they'll start to say that we don't have a there's also non-economic issues at stake. And a lot of the times that takes the form of people saying, well, but there's an inherent value in artists and creation that we can't measure in dollar value. Well, that's, you know, that I think there is room for that. And I'm sorry?
That goes both ways.
Yes, exactly. There's room for that, but there's also an inherent value in not freedom of speech and in not stopping people from speaking. And, you know, it seems strange, I think, to a lot of people, maybe not to the listeners of this podcast, that copyright is a speech issue, but, you know, because people will say, well, it's just somebody else's speech. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, quotation goes back a very long way. Anytime you see an epigram, anytime you refer to somebody else's work, I mean, that is your own speech based upon the speech of others. That's how conversations work. Right. I mean, you know, I'm responding to what you said and vice versa.
So I think that part of the reason we end up with a dichotomy is ultimately a public choice problem, because copyright law, like almost all laws end up being a negotiation between different stakeholders, unfortunately, right? And and here in DC, who are going to be these stakeholders who are going to be loud enough and squeaky wheel enough to come to that table, and it's going to be the usual suspects and it's these interests that are organized, which I don't blame them for doing, who right. make campaign contributions, for example.
Right, and also it's also not just loud enough, as you said, it's an organization problem that the interests of the public are incredibly diverse.
And so when you think about something like SOPA, that was a rare moment where the public sort of got involved. But again, it was because, maybe not because, but it's interesting to note that that interest was very tightly aligned with one of the two sides in the tech sector.
I think that certainly can help amplify. And that's the thing that I would want to make sure that policymakers recognize is that there was a large number of there was a huge number of people organically discontent with the direction that was going. I think that there can be a tendency to say, well, that was just because Google put a black square on their homepage that day. I seriously doubt that.
Yeah, no, we've had other podcasts explaining SOPA. So let's talk about the next sort of milestone here. The Commerce mm-hmm. Department released a new green paper on digital copyright policy. Do you want to tell us what a green paper is and what's the process that led up to it?
Well, I mean, the green paper is the idea behind it is it's more speculative is probably not the right word, but it's less a statement of administration doctrine than a white paper would be.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I can tell, there was an interagency process between Commerce, PTO, NTIA, so between the Patent Office, which actually does have a branch devoted to copyright policy, and the NTIA, the National Telecommunications Infrastructure Agency.
Administration.
Oh, Jesus.
Whatever.
Yeah. It's been a long day. there's a calibration of views amongst departments there.
Right. It's when you read it, I mean, there are a few recommendations or a few statements of policy, but in general, it is sort of a summation of the state of play and a general view of the administration.
Right.
So what is the significance of this?
Well, I think a lot of it does seem to parallel the sort of statements that you see coming out of the IP enforcement coordinator, where you'll have a statement of, a statement of the state of play and then a handful of recommendations. I think there were a few things about this about the green paper that suggest that the conversation is not the exact same conversation that's been going on in years past, which is good. Mm-hmm. There's a recognition, a more explicit recognition of fair use. There's explicit recognition of some of the controversies around digital ownership and digital first sale, and an acknowledgement that sometimes you do have remedies and enforcements to a copyright law that can create potential problems. It doesn't explicitly say that these things it doesn't take a stance on, for example, the idea that statutory damages are too high. But it says it will note, there have been a lot of people saying that statutory damages are too high.
And at the same time, it does say that, for example, penalties for streaming.
Yes.
Piracy is not the same as...
It does actually, and I think it does make an explicit recommendation that there should be felony penalties available for online streaming.
Right. It's interesting, though, as you say, that there is a much more explicit recognition of the balance that needs to be struck. And as you say, they mentioned fair use. They mentioned digital first sale, remixes, orphan works. So I guess that's that makes one optimistic, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and especially the coverage of remixes was encouraging, the way in which it was handled. You know, so it's nice to see that there are some issues that I think were vastly underplayed before getting some attention now. You know, on the other hand, a lot of the document also just did seem to reflect a. It was very similar to the direction things have been going in. There's some certain assumptions about its worldview that I think made me think that, you know, it's not an entire paradigm shift, but it shows that the conversation is proceeding. To take the example of you know, somewhere early on in the introduction, it says something to the effect of. There's digital technology and the internet has brought all sorts of benefits to content creators. You know, people are selling stuff on iTunes and we have Spotify and all of this stuff. But the same technologies that make that available also made online piracy possible. And I'm thinking, well, chronologically, that's kind of backwards. because all of those things sort of came about because nobody in the content industry was doing anything with that technology until people sort of, you know, almost hobbyists said, well, come on, seriously.
Yeah, you can use this for music, guys.
Yeah, you can use this for music. I can get it in a file about, you know, small enough to fit a bunch on my hard drive, and I can get singles, which right. Nobody sells. Well, they didn't before. How many CD singles existed?
Oh, no, Sherwin. It sounds to me like you're celebrating piracy.
Well, it sounds like I'm dating myself, too.
So something else that was mentioned in this green paper, but I think that also the Registrar of Copyright mentioned it in her statement, is updating the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to tell us, we're running out of time, you want to tell us in about 2 minutes what the DMCA is, what it does, and what some people think, how some people think it should be updated?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think, you know, in this context, I think when people talk, there's often two things people are talking, two completely different things
right.
when people talk about the DMCA. But in this case, they're talking about the safe harbor provisions.
Right.
So this is where basically it says that, you know, if you're an online service provider, you're a website, like I think YouTube is probably the easiest mm-hmm. example. You know, you run YouTube, somebody uploads something infringing onto your site. The idea is you're not liable for copyright infringement because one of your users infringed copyright if somebody, you know,
if somebody uploads the latest Hollywood blockbuster to YouTube.
Right. So, you know, somebody uploads that movie and the movie studio comes to me and says, hey, see this link here? That goes to a movie that's ours. It's infringing. Take it down. If I take it down, I have no copyright liability as the ISP. The person who uploaded it still has plenty of liability.
Right.
So that's the basic idea behind the DMCA in, you know, overly simplified terms. And I think one of the things is a lot of the movie studios and record labels,